Hello everyone, this is Jacinta Kitt here. I'm just going to do a short presentation, about a half an hour, on building our psychological capital. That may sound very highfalutin, but it's actually not. It is really about building our psychological resources so that we are able to cope with these challenging times. Very challenging for teachers and those in education because, quite frankly, we don't know whether we're coming or going. The one thing we do know is that we're doing our best. A lot of teachers working really hard at home, helping the students in a variety of ways, supporting them. And I think, by and large, being appreciated for it. I think perhaps the role of teachers is better understood and better appreciated during these times, particularly when parents are endeavouring to do some schoolwork at home with their children. But we need help ourselves, and we need support, and we need to be able to keep going. So with that in mind, I've put together this presentation on psych cap, as it is known. And basically, psychological capital, capital of any sort, refers to our resources. So our financial capital is our financial resources, our social capital is our social resources, and our psychological capital is obviously in that line as well. So financial resources at the moment, yes, somewhat out of our control. You know, a lot of people are being paid, a lot of people are not being paid. There are pressures on people financially. Our social resources are somewhat outside our control in terms of not being able to meet with whoever we want, where we want, and when we want. But our psychological resources, we do have some say and some power and some control over them. And generally speaking, psychological capital, or psych cap, is referred to in terms of having a positive attitude, having a can-do attitude. And there are four components to it, which we will discuss in a moment. And psychological capital is not a trait. It's not something you're born with. You're born with certain talents, certain abilities, certain features, certain levels of IQ, for example. But your psychological capital is a state, not a trait. It's something that you learn and you pick up on based on the behavior and the relationships that you have, the behavior of your parents and the relationships that you have with them. So the one good thing about our psychological capital, or our positive disposition, is we can take control of it and we can improve it. So the four components of psychological capital, or psych cap, are hope, optimism, self-efficacy, broadly speaking, confidence, and resilience. And there has been quite a bit of discussion about those elements in perhaps a different context. In particular, resilience. There's a lot of work now done in schools on building the resilience of children in the context of the difficulties that they may face in life. But we're going to deal with each one of them separately. And you can see here that I have quite a lot of writing on these slides here. And to be honest, I would never normally put, that's really slide content overload. But for the purposes of trying to get as much of each component discussed and explained, I have overloaded it on the slides, and forgive me for that. But I love the definition of hope of Shade, who says hope functions to energize and sustain the self as it reconstructs itself in trying circumstances. And that is certainly, if you take hope to in terms of that definition, that's certainly something that we need in these challenging times. We need something to sustain ourselves, and we need hope that it'll reconstruct itself through our own actions and through our own interventions. So hope is considered to be essential for our happiness and our success. Interestingly, in terms of teaching, teaching is often described in the literature in varying terms, including teaching is described as the discipline of hope, the profession of hope, and I've seen somewhere it described as a vocation of hopefulness. So we have a major role in our profession in being high in hope ourselves, and also in being able to instill hope in students. So I suppose for the purpose of this presentation, we're going to look at our own levels of hope. And hope is the opposite of fatalism, hopelessness, despair. And fatalism is often described in terms of an unwillingness to change or improve, an adherence to the status quo. I've been doing it that way for 50 years and I'm not going to change now. Leave well enough alone. And when you think of it, it's a very stuck position to be in. And you know, if we're not moving, it's very bad for us physically. If we're not moving, even around the house, marching on the spot, running up and down the stairs, it's very bad for us. And psychologically, stuck is also equates in some ways to hopelessness and often to despair. So hope is practical, it's pragmatic. It's not just it says, oh, I hope it'll be all right. Oh, I hope you'll be well next week. It's not just aspirational, but it's practical and pragmatic. And how it manifests itself is in setting goals for ourselves, setting goals, pursuing the goals, and then attaining the goals. And the more success you have, the more hopeful you become. So it's a kind of a circular, reciprocal kind of an arrangement. And setting goals for ourselves, they can be, in these times, small goals, medium-sized goals, large goals. It can be the goal of, I'm going to walk every day. It can be the goal of, I'm only going to drink two glasses of wine every day. Or it can be about, oh, I'm going to try and manage my emotions, and I'm going to try to keep my mouth shut when I feel like giving out or shouting or admonishing somebody. It can be small goals, but it's about setting them, and then it's about pursuing them and attaining them. And so, as I said, then it becomes cyclical in terms of being more hopeful. It is about having the will. So, you can set goals. You have to have the will, though, to pursue them. And then not just the will, but the ways, the practical ways. So to outline how I'm going to achieve them. And maybe if they're very big goals, parceling them into smaller ones. And, you know, hope places the reality of our achievements in the context of future possibilities. So when we manage to attain a goal, we have a sense of achievement, and that then can be placed in the context of trying new things and trying further things. So really, in terms of setting goals, it is about prioritizing. You know, which are the most important ones? Which are the ones that I am going to really stick with? You know, some of them might be a bit aspirational and mightn't be possible to do in the short term. So prioritize. What are the goals that I am setting myself? What are my priorities? Persisting, even when things go wrong. And not procrastinating. Not saying tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. So hope. If we can increase our levels of hope, it means that we are increasing our positive disposition, and it is really good for overcoming obstacles and challenges. Optimism, then, closely linked. These elements are not entirely separate. These four components are not entirely separate. They're linked in some way. If hope is a sense of what is possible, optimism is a sense of what is probable. in my opinion. That's how I write about it in my book. So Oscar Wilde puts it quite irreverently and quite well when he says, "Twixt optimist and pessimist, the difference is droll. The optimist sees the donut and the pessimist sees the hole." And it's quite interesting in terms of optimism and pessimism. Pessimism, that both of them are contagious. But they say pessimism can be slightly more contagious. So you know the person that's always giving out, always seeing the glass half empty. Oh, that'll never work. Oh, we tried that 10 years ago, didn't work then, won't work now. And you know somebody who's very pessimistic coming in the morning into school and perhaps saying something like, oh, another day in this awful old place. And even the person who's in good form is inclined to say, oh, I know, because pessimistic people drag you down. And, you know, really, it's about how you explain things to yourself. You know, they explain things to themselves in the worst possible scenario. So they explain things to themselves, pessimists I'm talking about here, in terms of the three P's. So something bad happens and they either blame themselves. Oh, I've made a show of myself. Oh, I've made bags of that. Oh, everybody will think this of me and that of me and the other of me. So they personalize it. And then they attach the second P is permanence. Oh, I'll never get over it. If I live to be 100, I'll never get over it. This is going to stay with me forever. So they put a permanence to something that has happened. And then they put a pervasive. Oh, this isn't just going to affect me in my job, in my home. Everyone's going to hear about it. My reputation is going to be ruined. So they think of it in terms of spreading out into every other area of their lives. And when you do that, there's a sense of hopelessness about that and a sense of pessimism. So really what optimism is about expecting good things to happen. Now they're realistic expectations. So they're not expecting good things to happen like I'm going to win the lotto or, you know, like we're going to be out of this situation at the end of the week. And no, they're realistic, but it's expecting good things to happen. It's been good at overcoming obstacles when they do come along in our way. It's about being able to put problems into some kind of a perspective, you know, it's some kind of a narrow perspective, perhaps. It's about having a can-do attitude. And above all else, optimism, because it's contagious, it affects the mood and the mindset of ourselves, of course, but of those around us. So people like to be surrounded by those who are optimistic. Not overly optimistic, but realistically optimistic. And I often think of my own disposition in terms of optimism. And I have a tendency at times to be pessimistic. And one of the incidents where I would be more inclined to be pessimistic is where if I'm going, I've spent years travelling up and down the country visiting schools, hundreds of schools. I do a lot of work in schools. So I often have to travel. And very often now my husband, who's semi-retired, and although working harder than ever, would, if he's free, he'll bring me because he can work, you know, on his laptop while I'm working in the school. And, you know, when we live quite near the M50, and when we get onto the M50 in the morning, you've no indication before you get onto it. When you get onto it, your fate is more or less decided in terms of the time it's going to take you to get to your destination. Because if it's bumper to bumper, you know you're in trouble. Now, I'm inclined to immediately presume we're going to be late. Oh, my God, I'm going to have to ring the school. I'm going to have to speak. Oh, they're going to be waiting for me. Oh, my God. But my husband, au contraire, is inclined to, you know, kind of stick his neck out, curve his neck around the road, as it were, and say, no, I think we'll be okay. I see a bit of movement up there in Firhouse, which is about 5 kilometres away, I hasten to add. But, you know, even when he says it, there's an inclination for me to feel a little bit better, to sigh, and maybe even to think, well, it doesn't matter because what can I do about it anyway? So optimism and pessimism, both contagious. And it is about realising our own levels of either optimism or pessimism. And you know, people who are pessimistic are very slow to see it themselves, very slow to have self-awareness about themselves. They can't see themselves as the complainer and the giver-outer. So you can see how important self-awareness is there. Self-awareness is the gap between how others see us and how we see ourselves. And so how are we ever going to see ourselves unless we ask others, how do you think I handle that situation? But we have to be prepared to hear the answer. But I'm digressing a bit there into self-awareness, which will probably be for another little presentation if anyone's interested. So optimism is asking about what's good about things. So when something happens and you immediately think it's bad, say, what's good about it? What's good about, a certain birthday, a roundy birthday, as Ronan Collins describes it as a roundy birthday. Or, you know, what's good about maybe somebody is planning an outing to a Chinese restaurant or an Italian restaurant and you don't want to go and you say, oh, I hate those places, all out pizza and pasta. But instead of jumping to that conclusion, you say, well, what's good about it? And let them tell you, oh, no, you can get chicken and fish and whatever. So asking what's good about things, trying to see the best in others, because pessimists are inclined to see the worst in others and to give out about them. And giving out is an awful waste of energy. And, you know, people generally don't like others who give out. They generally drag others down as well. So try to see the best in things. Give new ideas the benefit of the doubt. Oh, well, now I don't really think I want to do that, but I'll give it a go. I'll have a go. And that's, you know, helps you to try new things and surround yourself with positive people, because positive people and positivity, as we said, is contagious. Now, self-efficacy is one that is frequently written about in terms of our job as teachers, you know, the importance of self-efficacy, the importance of, you know, believing in yourself and having the confidence to do your job. And you need a lot of confidence to do such an important job. Teaching is second most important job in the world in terms of influencing others, for society, as members of society. Parents having the first and most important job, but teachers follow a very close second. So it's very important for us, if we are doing such a vital job, an influential job, that we would have a belief in ourselves. But it has to be realistic. It's a realistic view of our abilities, backed up by skills and competence. So in order to get it, you have to work at it. You have to ensure that you do the right things so that you will have the competence. And then it's about recognizing it. So it is self-belief and it is confidence. And, you know, confidence is very important in terms of doing things, because we regulate our level and distribution of efforts in accordance with the effects that we expect our actions to have. So if we expect our actions to have fruitful and beneficial effects, we put a lot more into it. So really, really important in terms of our efforts and in terms of our application and in terms of our dedication. Also, just to say that people who are genuinely confident, they're not threatened by the confidence or the competence of others. They feel quite content in their own abilities. And so they're able to give acknowledgement and give praise to others. And isn't it lovely to be surrounded by people who give acknowledgement and praise? Because we absolutely need it. Of course, those who can't, they withhold it. Is it stick in their craw to say a nice thing? And, you know, one of the most prevalent forms of psychological abuse is the blatant or purposeful withholding of recognition, where a person sees that you've done something nice but withholds it, keeps it back. And that is doing an awful lot of damage to the person who's not getting it, but it's also doing an awful lot of damage to the person who's doing the withholding. Not being afraid to admit to being wrong. That's something that's a very big part of confidence. I learned that lesson the hard way. I remember going with a colleague to do an interview. Oh, it's quite a number of years ago now. We were doing an interview in order to take on the role of helping, it was the central bank at the time, to evaluate their methodology of I suppose, assessing the levels of progress in staff and in the methodologies that they were using to do the work, quite simply, although I'm making it sound quite complex. And we went for the interview anyway, and there were four or five men interviewing myself and my colleague, another woman. And one of them asked, in the course of the questions, asked something about a certain syndrome. Would you be using this syndrome? I can't remember the name of it now. I did not have a clue what the man was talking about. And I bluffed. I said, well, we're not quite sure yet. I said, we'll have to discuss that with each other. We'll come back to you on it. And of course, you know, I was panicking at this stage. And then he turned to my colleague and he said, what do you think? Do you think you'll be using this syndrome? And she said, I'm sorry, I'm not sure what that syndrome is. I wonder, would you mind, you know, elaborating on it? I thought to myself, oh my God, look at how much easier it was to admit to being wrong. And I had an awful sense of shame that, in fact, you know, I couldn't do it. But I learned from it. And I learned there's liberation and there's freedom in being able to say, I'm sorry, I don't know that. I'm not familiar with that. It's the opposite to this letting on and the pretending, which is very hard on us if we do it. So I suppose self-efficacy is really about self-esteem, building our self-esteem. And, you know, we used to talk about self-esteem in terms of being low or high. Oh, that person has very low self-esteem. Oh, she's marvellous, very high self-esteem. But we recognise now that those two terms are not really that appropriate, because low self-esteem certainly is, you know, a lack of confidence and a lack of belief in yourself. But high self-esteem is often indicative of unhealthy self-esteem as well, because it may include conceitedness or boastfulness or unrealistic notions of your abilities or whatever. So we talk more about self-esteem now in terms of healthy self-esteem. So it's really back to the beginning of this realistic view of your abilities, rather than the high or the low. And of course, self-efficacy and confidence is absolutely contingent on the support we get from others. We all need acknowledgement, support, recognition. We all need constructive rather than critical feedback. And, you know, the support that we need is often very much more pointed if we are in difficulties, if we're having difficulties, that someone is there to support us. And, you know, if we do have a sense of success, the more success that we have, the more confident we become. So you can apply a lot of what I'm saying here in terms of support, acknowledgement, feedback and support in difficult times to what we do with children every day. And, you know, I am going to incorporate with this presentation an article that I wrote about building psychological capital in our schools, if you're interested in that. And so, and finally, is the resilience. And resilience, you know, is something that we are quite familiar with because it's incorporated into the curriculum in various dimensions and helping children to become more resilient. But interestingly, I suppose resilience is often used to prevent people from getting stressed. But we are more or less susceptible to stress depending on how we think about the things that happen to us. So resilience is really about how we think about things. And it's often described, and you'll see I have a question mark after it there, it's often described as bouncing back from adversity. Well, I have a serious question mark over that, because I think it is almost impossible to bounce back from adversity. So suppose, for example, your significant other or somebody at work says something that hurts you or angers you, and you know you feel that hurt and you feel that anger, but you say to yourself, oh, I'm resilient, I'm going to bounce right back. Well, very difficult. So I think maybe adversity should be described more in terms of clawing back or crawling back, but certainly getting back, getting our equilibrium back, because we start with kind of a degree of equilibrium and then something happens and the balance is upset. So it's about restoring the balance or getting back to where we were. And one of the things that's very important is in terms of, you know, adversity is putting things into perspective. Because the ABCs is used in a lot of the psychological literature, and that A stands for adversity, something bad that has happened. The B stands for the beliefs we have about it. So the beliefs. And the C stands for the consequences. So generally speaking, it's not the adversity that causes the consequences. It's the beliefs we have about the adversity. And whereas sometimes we can't do anything about the bad thing that happened, we can do an awful lot about our beliefs. That's the point of intervention for resilience. And ascertaining the importance of the bigger picture, putting things into perspective, I suppose. And, you know, I read a book, I have the crisis scale there, because I read a book about, I think the name of it was Resilience. And the girl who wrote the book, she described resilience in terms of putting things on the crisis scale. So she gave a score of 10 on the crisis scale for death, divorce, and natural disaster. Now, some people have said to me when I quote that book, she have said to me, well, I wouldn't put divorce up there. Divorce could be a good thing. And of course, it could be a good decision for people and could be the right decision for people. But because of the traumatic nature of it, in terms of the ending of a very, very important, if not the most important relationship in our lives, it also can be traumatic for children involved. So I'd leave it up there at the 10. So death, divorce, and natural disaster. So then when something happens, you decide where you are going to put it on the crisis scale. So if it's something that really gets you, like you know, ask your significant other to bring home a litre of full fat milk, and they bring home a litre of slimline milk with the pink writing on it, and you raise it up into an international incident. What sort of an idiot are you at all? Can you not read or whatever? And you know, when you think of the milk or the carton of milk in the context of the crisis scale, where would you put it? You might put it on -2, actually. Well, maybe 0. Well, depending on your mood, maybe 2. But you wouldn't put it at a 10. And so it helps you to defuse, to bring things down, to not give them a status, an international status in terms of crisis. One of the most important things for building our resilience is to is the quality of our relationships. If we have mutually empathic and responsive relationships, it's a great source of resilience from us. And oftentimes when we're thinking about our relationships, we're inclined to blame the other person in the relationship. But the only way we can change the behaviour of someone else is by changing our own. So it's learning, I suppose, not to overreact. It's learning to bite your tongue sometimes. It's learning to let things go. All of those things help our resilience. Children children's resilience is very, very important for us in school, how we present things, how we contextualize things, and the very same at home. They need protective factors and processes to help them to build resilience. You can imagine the anxieties and the worries that could creep into children's minds during these times as they overhear perhaps the news, as they overhear their parents talking. So really important for children to build their resilience in the classroom and in the home now in particular by providing protective context for them. So the two intelligences that we need in terms of all of those four components of psychological capital are emotional and social intelligence. And quite simply, if you break those two intelligences down, they're often linked together, but they're also often separated from each other because they are quite different. Emotional intelligence is actually regarded as being having a positive disposition overall. So what it actually means in terms of emotional intelligence, it means that when good emotions hit us, like joy and happiness and fulfillment and all of those, achievement or whatever they are, that we hold on to them, that we don't let them go. So we look out the window in the morning and we see the sun shining, that we can hold on to that lovely feeling of joy instead of saying, it'll probably be raining in an hour, I won't bother putting out the washing. So it's about holding on to the positive emotions and letting go of the negative ones in as far as possible. And social intelligence, quite simply, is about getting on well with others. It's interesting that a lot of people describe those two intelligences to me in terms of those newfangled intelligences. You know, I teach quite a bit about emotional and social intelligence on my course in the MEd in Trinity over the last 20 years, and more recently on the MEd in Maynooth University just during this crisis where I stepped in for somebody else. And oftentimes people would say to me, I've no real time for those newfangled intelligences. And it's quite interesting in terms of the first quote that I have there. Well, it's not exactly a quote, I've paraphrased it, but it's Thorndike, 1920, famous psychologist who described social intelligence as the ability to act wisely in human relations. Isn't that just gorgeous? The ability to say the right thing, the ability to know when to speak and when not to speak. Isn't it a wonderful skill to have? Something I'd love to build on myself, and we all should be trying to build it, to act wisely in human relations. It's the ability to make others feel the better for an encounter with you. So we all have people in our lives that when we put down the phone from them, we feel the worse for the encounter. They say things that make us feel worse. Well, we have to try, when we think of it in terms of ourselves, of when the other person puts down the phone from us, do they feel the better or the worse for the encounter? It's the ability to show empathy and understanding. It's the ability to acknowledge and give recognition to others. That's a wonderful thing for building your social intelligence. And, you know, giving acknowledgement and giving recognition, I think I might have mentioned this already, gives great pleasure to others, but it also gives yourself a good feeling. To admit to being wrong, as we discussed previously, and to be able to apologise. Some people can't apologise to save their lives, but it's very important. It takes away about 75% of the hurt, not all of the hurt, but 75%. And if something is bothering you, if you're carrying around what we call baggage, baggage can be like bags of rock, bags of granite rock. If you're carrying around something, do something about it. Tell the other person how you feel. And if you can't do that, just let it go. Really liberating and really important. So I hope that some of the things that I've mentioned will be of some help to you. And I hope that I didn't overwhelm you with the slides that go with it. You can listen to it on its own if you want, but ideally the slides supplement and complement the presentation. And thank you very much for listening. And I wish you all continued good health, and hope you stay safe and take care. Bye-bye.